We'll go ahead and get started. We're a few minutes late. If we could have someone towards the back get the door for us, I'd appreciate that. My name is Michael Stevens. I will be responding to Carrie Miles' paper. Let me just remind everybody real quick, turn off your cell phones, beepers, pagers, sounding devices, and so on. This is session number 222, A Testimony of Motherhood, LDS Response to Changing Women's Roles from 1940 to 2006. Our presenter is Dr. Carrie Miles, a senior research associate at the Consortium for the Economic Study of Religion. How's that for a paradox? Author of this book, The Redemption of Love, Rescuing Marriage from the Economics of a Fallen World, shortly to be reviewed in Sunstone. But you don't have to wait to get your own copy. They are available in the Harvest Room right after this session. So as soon as we're done, I highly encourage you to get your hands on this book. It is a wonderful overview for those of you who love a great meaty gospel barbecue. So head out the session. Do not pass go, but take $200, go right to the booksellers and get a copy of the book. Carrie Miles also has in her notes here, she's married to an economist, Larry Iadocone, for over 150 years, you said something like that? All right, congratulations. And has two children. So Carrie, we'll go ahead and turn the podium over to you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here today. In my book, I look at the economic reasons for the historic subordination of women and the traditional family structure. Traditional is a bad word, but the historic family structure that had the woman in the household and the man outside of it. And I look at how the movement of, how technological changes caused women to move out of the household and set off all of the things we saw happening in the last 50 years with family roles. And this paper, I'm going to be talking about the problems that that kind of change causes for religious institutions. Change in important areas like this cause problems for churches because churches have boundaries between themselves and the environment. And when you agree to join or be part of a religious institution, you're agreeing to those boundaries between the church and the rest of the world. And so you see it in the things that you're asking a temple recommend. These are things that you are supposed to do that perhaps your non-believing neighbor is not asked to do. The word of wisdom was a typical boundary maintenance device. It used to be before we've had so much health concerns about smoking and drinking and so forth that was something that really set Mormons apart, and it still does in a lot of ways. So when there's a technological or social change, you have an emergent difference with the social environment, and this creates a new boundary between the church and its broader social environment. And this raises the cost of belonging for the members, right? Because this is not something you agreed to when you joined the church or decided that you were going to be a participant in the church. And it raises your costs in terms of foregone opportunities. And as we start talking about the church's response to changing roles of women, you'll see what I'm talking about here. But for the institutions, this creates a double bind because to change violates the boundaries, but to not change violates the boundaries as well. Okay, so if the church goes along with the social change, now they're doing something different than what people agreed to, and if they resist the change, then they're causing new costs for the members as well. So it's a double bind. And there's this great line from Alice in Wonderland where the Red Queen says, "Here you see it takes all the running you can do to stay in the same place." And that's the problems that the church faced in the middle of the 20th century. Okay, my issue here are gender norms, talk about what women should be doing, And my methodology was a content analysis of all of the articles in the improvement era, which was the earlier version of the Ensign, and in the Ensign that were indexed under women, motherhood, birth control, all the kind of women's roles issues. And this was originally my doctoral dissertation, and I've updated it for here. So I went back to 1940 in the church publications, and for the 1990s and on, I've used the church website, lds.org, which has which messes up my index count, but because you're getting everything, which is a huge number, anytime women are mentioned. Okay. Most conservative religions did resist the movement of women out of the household in the middle of the 20th century. But I'm arguing that this is more of a problem for Mormonism because of our doctrines around polygamy had reified or even deified our concepts of gender. Now, if you read the kind of generic Christian literature at the same time, they're going to be saying the same sorts of things. You could read the Ensign article, and you can read something that was being published by a conservative Christian author, and you'd think they were the same. But it was less of a problem for your basic Protestant Christian, because although members of these groups tend to think about God as male, and they tend to think that marriage and family life and having children are marks of a good godly life, that you're not a mature Christian or Jew or whatever unless you're married and have children, they realize that this isn't, when you push comes to shove, that's not doctrine among other Christian churches. And they have to admit when push comes to shove that God is a spirit and he's not really a male. But the Church of Latter-day, Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, teaches that God is a physical being who is literally male, and that sex and gender and marriage and family relationships have always existed and will continue forever. So we have reified that to take an abstract concept and make it real. We have gone beyond reifying gender and family roles and deified it in a way. So you can see where for other Christians, they can start slipping on this issue in ways that the Mormon Church couldn't. And whether or not it has actually been more difficult of an issue for the Mormon Church is kind of an empirical question that I haven't addressed, but I think it's probably true. Now, before the change in the mid-20th century, society and religion are pretty much the same about how they feel about the household, the sexual division of labor, what women should be doing. Or they're so similar that the differences are not remarkable. Laura Vance, who's a sociologist, did a content analysis of the improvement era and the Ensign on these issues. And she went back to 1891, which was when the improvement era started. And she found that in the first 50 years of publication, from 1891 to about 1940, there were only 18 talks or articles about women. Now, this isn't that remarkable because the improvement era starts out as Young Men's Magazine. But this is not a real salient issue. You first start seeing more talk about women's roles in the 1940s as women are entering the war industries. Okay, all the men are off fighting World War II, and there is a market for female labor. So in 1942, there's a couple of pieces in the improvement era. One of them was by the first presidency of the church. David O. McKay was president at that time. And this was significant. They say the divine service of motherhood can be rendered only by mothers. Now, this is, as far as I can tell, the first mention ever of motherhood as divine. It may not be passed to others. Nurses cannot do it. Public nurseries cannot do it. Hired help cannot do it. The mother who entrusts her child to the care of others, that she may do non-motherly work, whether for gold, for fame, or for civic service, should remember that a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. Okay, so this was the first mention of the divinity of motherhood. But then we enter the post-war era, And again, this issue sort of drops off the scene as you've got the baby boom going, this kind of great return to domesticity following the Second World War. So there's very little attention to women's behavior in the enzyme. When does it switch to the improvement era? In the 60s, I think. 71, thank you. So there's a little attention to women's behaviors in the 50s, and often while articles there are, kind of encourages and brags about women's accomplishments. And they say the whole world is open to women now, and look at the great things that our Mormon women are doing. However, that shouldn't be put ahead of having a family, but they're bragging about it. All right, so technological change leads to social and economic change. Prior to the middle of the 20th century, or even earlier, most production took place in the home, and the household produced most of what it consumed. So you needed a lot of labor, you needed a lot of children to help with the work. And what the women were doing in the household, she wasn't just tidying up, she wasn't just cleaning the house. She is vitally involved. The things that women produced were critical to household survival. But with the development of the automated flour mill and cheap transportation, this allowed the mass production of foodstuffs. And this happens around 1800, about 200 years ago. We start developing piped-in water, more efficient ways of heating the household. And the men were the first to leave the household because it now became more efficient for them to go and get a job and buy wheat flour than it was to grow corn themselves. So the men leave the household first. And the children, who you needed to bring in the water and to gather the firewood and to help with the farm work, things that they're doing starts to leave the home as well. So the children start leaving the home now to work in this new economy. They need education, so they're going to school. They become more and more expensive. Before they're an item of production, now they're becoming an expense. And you see the birth rate drop like a rock. 1800, the average American woman had 7.3 children. By 1900, she has a little less than four. By 2000, she has less than one. It's probably only that high in the United States because of immigration. But if you look at a lot of European countries, if you look at Japan, they're getting close to one. Did I say two? The average American woman has two. Okay. So you see the birth rate drop like a rock. And further, by the 1930s, there are laws passed saying children have to go to school and you can't send them out to work. There's all these child labor laws. And by the mid 20th century, this trend is continuing with women too. Women are more and more moving into the paid labor force. But I think this is a trend that's disrupted by World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, and then this big return to domesticity in the 50s. But by the 1960s, you've gone from 14% of married women employed in 1940 to something like 40% of married women employed by the late 1960s. And you have Betty Friedan writing The Feminine Mystique in 1963. Because much of the things that the women had done in the household had moved out too. Now, I'm not saying that keeping house isn't still a very time-consuming task. But the things that women do in the household are no longer critical to survival the way that they used to be. And take something, and a lot of things that women used to do that were really important for their family's comfort have become expensive luxuries. And take something like keeping the hearth fire burning. When you were cooking on an open hearth, heating the house with an open hearth, this was something that took a lot of time every day. It was an important feminine function. Your family's safety, health, depended on keeping the hearth fire burning. Well, if you live in Palo Alto, you know that it's now against the law to have a wood-burning fire in your home. So a lot of things like this have become expensive luxuries, and women have responded, like men and children, by leaving the home. Okay. The church responded to this change by strongly resisting it at first. Now, the church has always affirmed women's equality with men. But when it came to issues about the different roles of men and women in the 60s, now they're going to start reacting to this. And in 1963, then Apostle Spencer W. Kimball, issued one of the first calls in this era for women to stay out of the labor market. And he quotes a judge who says, that this is, you're going to hear this echoed down through the next few decades here. Get women out of the factories and put them back into the home where they belong, cooking, sewing, cleaning house, and doing the traditional woman's work. It would do both them and their neglected youngsters a world of good. Now, he's going to repeat this in 1977 as the president of the church, but this theme of mother come home is going to be echoed over the next 40 years. Some other concerns that we see in the Ensign at this point around the movement of women out of the household were things like Barlow, who was a, Philip, what's that his name? A BYU professor, and he expressed alarm over the fact that working outside the home gave a wife too much power in her relationship with her husband. And such a wife challenged the divinely ordained patriarchal order in which the husband was to preside and must inevitably disrupt the home. Similarly, Apostle Boyd K. Packer in 1977 called on these perceived gender differences when he wrote, a man needs to feel protective and yes, dominant, if you will, in leading his family. A woman needs to feel protected. What would it be like if they both naturally needed to feel dominant all the time? Now, my parents' generation talked a lot about the D word, about the need for male dominance. But that soon became unacceptable to talk about dominance and submission in the marriage relationship. And in fact, the LDS literature pretty much drops that term and starts talking about how, well, the husbands are to preside over the family, but they're to do it in love, and they need to take their wives' opinion in it. And they've kind of defined it down to not really meaning a whole lot. But this is something that happens later. Another article that I think that captures quite well some of the resistance was by Bishop Burke Peterson in 1974. And he wrote, earning a few dollars more for luxuries, cloaked in the masquerade of necessity, or a so-called opportunity for self-development of talents in the business world, a chance to get away from the mundane responsibilities of the home. These are all satanic substitutes for clear thinking. So there's a lot of talk about the attack on motherhood and women's roles as satanic as well. And Peterson advised parents that before they decided they needed a second income, they should go to God in prayer and make sure he approves. And further, he wrote, no babysitter, no grandmother, no neighbor, no friend, no relief society sister, older brother or sister, or even a loving dad can take your place. Now compare this with the 1942 First Presidency Statement. They warned that neither nurses, public nurseries, or hired help could replace a mother's divine service. Peterson is including other church members, family members, and even a loving dad. So this is significant, and this is probably one of the stronger responses here. So there's more high-level church officials addressing the single issue of self-fulfillment and the women's employment out of the home in the 1970s than had spoken to all of women's issues in the 1950s. This becomes very salient in the number of articles indexed under women, and women's roles in the 70s rise dramatically. The church starts experiencing some pressure now at this point, and you remember Sonia Johnson and the whole church's involvement in the anti-Equal Rights Amendment campaign in the late 70s. So they start getting some publicity perhaps they don't care for. But there was a book published in 78 by a non-member named Marilyn Warensky called Patriarch in Politics, The Plight of the Mormon Woman. Now, I asked you to consider this book. I don't know how influential the book was, but its title captures some of the growing disconnect between church teachings and the popular American culture. Much of LDS doctrine is built around the word patriarchy. And again, I'm arguing this is coming from our polygamous past and doctrines that grew up around polygamy. So you've got the patriarchal priesthood, patriarchal marriage, patriarchal family, a patriarchal blessing. And this word is fast becoming a pejorative. So again, the other Christian churches can abandon this word, but Mormons are kind of stuck with it. It's not like dominance where you can stop talking about it. But the sources of pressure were not all external. The quantitative data from my earlier study found that while the church's affirmation of historic roles strengthened the commitment of the more experienced members, it weakened that of younger, less experienced members, and also affected potential converts. Okay, so there's that double bind. By resisting change, you're alienating the people who want to accept that change, who are losing things by not being able to participate in this worldly trend. At the same time, if they accepted the change, then they're alienating the older members who grew up with these norms and are used to this. And this weakening commitment could also be seen in falling partition rates of young women, which Hinckley and Elder Goslin hinted about in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's important to see that female members of the church are following the same trends and in employment and decreased family size as other American women. And while LDS women have always had more children than average than the American population as a whole, it's only been like one or two child per family, which granted is a lot. But as the American birth rate drops, the Mormon birth rate parallels it with a child or two more, but it's also dropping. And married LDS women in general are participating in the paid workforce. As far as we can tell, we don't have good data. But it looks like they're participating in the paid workforce at about the same rate as non-Mormon counterparts, although perhaps more are working part-time than full-time. Oh, there was a study done in 95 that suggested that the more religious you are, the less likely you are to work. And furthermore, LDS women are not working just for self-fulfillment or for luxuries, but the church did a couple of surveys that purportedly suggest that a lot of families would have been fairly poorly off economically if it weren't for the mother's income. So this was important. And of course, the church is also simultaneously emphasizing large families, college educations, and family-financed missions. So you really need two incomes there too. Okay, so the church initially responds by resisting this, but we're seeing now by the late 70s some accommodation. So while Peterson and others decried selfish motives for women's employment outside of the home, they nonetheless recognized that some women were their family's sole earners and must work. Such women, Peterson said, were exceptions. Nevertheless, the exceptions were becoming common enough that writers and speakers in the Ensign began to spell out the conditions under which a mother might go to work. And you know that the Ensign publishes all the conference talks, so many of these articles were actually conference talks. Ensign staff writer Lavina Fielding, who you may know by another name, summed up these accommodations, I think, fairly well in a 1976 article. While a mother's employment was not ideal, and this kind of summarizes the way this literature is going by the late 70s, if she has a true financial need and not just a desire for luxuries, it was all right for a mother to work. But there were very explicit conditions under which a mother could work. First, she had to make sure that her children were well cared for. She had to make this decision with her husband, so you, by implication there, you need your husband's approval. And then you must both pray about this and make sure that God approves. You need a personal revelation that it's okay. And if you meet all those conditions and God approves, then it was all right for mothers to work. But it was very important. Now, Lavina mentions this, and it shows up even in the current talks. You can't know if God's approved or not, so we can't judge each other. We don't know what other people's conditions are. As we move a little further here, we start seeing, though, that the women's need for work, for engagement with the world outside of the family, is about more than financial need. Okay, these were these allusions to self-fulfillment before. So from about the mid-1970s on, we start to see articles which urged women to put their family's needs before their own, but they also encourage a sequential arrangement in which women first raise families and then seek career or extra household activities either before they have children or when their children are grown. And Camille Kimball, the wife of the president of the church, in 1977 said that, earnings aside, another valid reason for a woman to prepare herself to fulfill a vocation is that not all of her lifetime could possibly be filled with demands of family, home, and children. When a mother's children are reared, and if she is childless or if she's childless, the years after 40 and 50 begin to look bleak. Let her study a profession or adopt a trade or find some absorbing subject for study and research. So we're seeing first resistance to the social change and then more and more accommodations to allow people to do what they need to do. And the extent of the accommodation becomes apparent in reactions to a talk that President Benson gave in 1987. Yeah, I see heads nodding. You all know what that was. Okay. In 1963, I read Kimball's talk, Calling Mothers to Come Home. In 1977, he repeats that talk. Now, in 63, in 77, these are just talks. They don't cause any particular uproar. They fit with what's happening at that time. But by 1987, President Benson gives a special fireside, and this is later published as a pamphlet that's sent out to everyone in the church, to the mothers in Zion. And he quotes President Kimball's Mothers Come Home. He says, "I beg of you, you who could and should be bearing and rearing a family, wives, come home from the typewriter, the laundry, the nursing, come home from the factory, the cafe. No career approaches the importance of that of wife, homemaking, mother, cooking meals, washing dishes, making beds for one's precious husbands and children." I'll have to be sure and leave some time for discussion here. "Come home, wives, to your husbands. Make home a heaven for them. Come home, wives, to your children, born and unborn. Wrap the motherly cloak about you and unembarrassed. Help in a major role to create bodies for the immortal souls who anxiously await." Okay, so when Kimball says this in 63 and 77, there's no big reaction. They fit in neatly with the other admonitions from the time period. However, when Benson quotes them in 97, it's quite out of keeping with the accommodations that have been made in the intervening years. And there was, I think, quite a bit of uproar about that. Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote an article about Mormon women quitting their jobs, feeling very conflicted and guilty for ignoring this mandate when they did. An Ensign article in 88 also recounts the guilt and consternation that resulted from this admonition to come home. However, despite the uproar, Benson's speech perhaps made little difference, because in 1990, the Ensign carries an article from the Relief Society presidency about child care options. And this just kind of blew me away, but saying, well, you need to not judge, and what do you do when mother can't be home? How do you make the best of your second choice? So the accommodations are continuing to progress, even though the Benson talk does cause an uproar. And we see the continuation of this Benson citation of Kimball's saga in 1996. President Hinckley said, "Some years ago, President Benson delivered a message to the women of the church. He encouraged them to leave their employment and give their individual time to their children. I sustain the position he took. Nevertheless, he recognized, that there are some women, it has become very many, in fact, who have to work to provide for the needs of their families. And to you, I say, do the very best you can. So now you start getting in the literature the idea that this is hard. He says it's well nigh impossible for a woman to have a family and a full-time career at the same time. But I know you're struggling with it, and we're praying for you, and we support you. And in, I'm not sure when the talk was given, I think it was in 2002, Peggy again writes another article where she's quoting Hinckley, and he writes about meeting an LDS nurse when he's in the hospital. And she's also raising three children while working. And he says there's such demand for people with her skills that she can do almost anything she pleases. She is the kind of woman you might dream of as you look to the future. So now we've gone in the 21st century providing role models for women on how to combine motherhood and working. And then Hinckley told the church's 12 to 18-year-old girls to study your options, pray to the Lord earnestly for direction, then pursue your course with resolution. The whole gamut of human endeavor is now open to women. So what we see here, what I think is going on in organizational level, is that the church is maintaining the ideals consistently throughout this period. But it's doing it, it's making accommodations for it at the same time so that people can do what they have to do. And the exceptions to the ideal are justified in terms of it. So you're holding up the ideal, but you're making accommodations in such a way that you're supporting the ideal too. Even the requirement that women seek divine approval for employment acknowledges that this is a rule so steadfast that only God can grant dispensations from it. Having decreed woman's divine role, only God and her husband can temporarily release her from it. When women talk about their employment, then it's in kind of deprecating terms. Often, I wish I didn't have to work, but I need a paycheck to sustain my family. And the leaders can respond, your situation is not ideal, but we feel sorry for you, but it's okay, do the best you can, we're praying for you. And this illustrates how organizations can exercise flexibility in practice while maintaining purity of doctrine. The economic and social shifts of the 60s took many women, families, and churches by surprise, and required that those straddling the boundaries between the church and society to renegotiate their commitment to the church. But while change can cause a crisis for the church and its members, differences with the culture per se are not necessarily a problem. And a well-calibrated gap between the church and society is critical for organizational strength and survival. And the leaders of strict organizations recognize this need for a difference. Hinckley, for example, stated, if we were entirely without criticism, we would be concerned. Our responsibility is not to please the world, but do the will of the Lord, which has so often been contrary to the ways of the world. So I think what we've seen in the church as we move past that crisis period in the 70s, some accommodations to it, but the change and the crisis has moved into a negotiated difference between the church and its environment now, where we're now known as the family-oriented church. You know, this is the big draw of the church. We protect and sustain families. So it's now a difference. It's part of the boundary maintenance. But maintaining and clarifying a difference or a boundary requires a lot of energy, too. And I am claiming that the Proclamation on the Family in 1995 was a part of the working out of this new boundary. There's a problem of supporting the LDS peculiar teachings about the nature, eternal nature of gender and family and the sexual division of labor in particular. You can't derive that from the Bible. And that's a big thing that I write about in my book. It's simply not there. And, you know, the peculiarly LDS doctrines don't talk too much about family doctrine either. The problem of supporting LDS family doctrine from scripture was explicitly acknowledged by Boyd Packer at a church educational system symposium. And he said the individual doctrines of the gospel are not fully explained in one place in the scriptures, nor presented in order or sequence. They must be assembled in bits and pieces. They're sometimes found in large segments, but mostly they're scattered around. So in 1995, the church solves all these problems by publishing the Proclamation on the Family. It spells out all of these things quite explicitly and provides a scriptural basis for the sexual division of labor by saying that fathers are to preside over the families in love and righteousness and provide, and mothers generally are responsible for the nurture of children. This hasn't been officially canonized, but you see frequent references to it. Members frame it and hang it on the wall alongside pictures of the temple. You've got general authority, Alden Porter, warning that if you're not yet married, if your proposed marriage partner is not in agreement with the doctrines taught therein, there's danger in committing your life to him or her. So people are bearing their testimony about the proclamation. It's a new boundary, okay? And I call this getting a testimony of motherhood because we're seeing increasingly in the Ensign people talking about motherhood in testimony-bearing terms, the divine nature of motherhood. And so there's a lot of these little vignettes where a frustrated mother writes about some dreadful thing their children did. They came downstairs and found the dog dressed in their nightgown, sitting at the dining room table eating out of her plate, you know. And how they're you know, at the end of their rope, and they need a testimony that what they're doing is right. They need a personal testimony, the divine calling of motherhood, or some other spiritual insight that helps them cope. The leaders in conference talks often bear witness to the divine nature of motherhood, and they're running up the value of motherhood and women staying in the home. And in fact, they'll say things like, motherhood is near to divinity. It's the highest, holiest service to be assumed by mankind, and imply that women are not only equal to men, they're superior to them. They lose something when compared to men. And President Hinckley recently said that Eve was made last because she was God's masterpiece. So we've got a lot of this really explicit testimony to this new doctrine. Relief Society Counselor Sherry Dew in 2001 talked about the doctrine of motherhood and said it is a doctrine. And I absolutely know that these doctrines about our divine role are true. Here's a statement by a member named Jean Yanoi in 1993, and it's a classic example of LDS testimony bearing formula. Writing of how prayer and inspiration helped her make the decision to stay at home, she said, I'm grateful to be a mother. I bear a testimony that mother is, in the words of my patriarchal blessing, a great and important work given to the women of the church. I thank God for this privilege. I bear testimony of his love and interest in helping us. A 2000 piece by convert, Marion Pons, provides perhaps the most enlightening example of how a religious organization's difference with its social environment requires explicit acceptance of the new boundary. In 1977, Pons was a graduate student planning a career in biochemistry, which is a very male-dominated field. She wrote, I certainly did not plan to be a mother. When she became interested in joining the church, she struggled to reconcile her career goals with teachings about the importance of motherhood. Writing in her journal, my heart really wants to know if in truth the role of wife and mother is my place, and if I find it is, I hope God will grant me the grace and acceptance to grow in that role. And she studied and prayed and attended church and eventually came to the assurance that motherhood was her role, that it was okay to join the church, and gave up her feminist-oriented compass, as she puts it today. So to join the church today, the potential member, especially a woman, has to obtain a testimony not just of the truthfulness of the church, but also a testimony of the eternal and important role of motherhood. And let me just sum up by saying that this approach is actually probably a very good one organizationally. The church isn't going to change enough to appeal to the feminist women who don't join churches anyway. You still have a large segment of the American population who are home with their children, so it's not like they've been completely abandoned. The change in women's employment rates pretty much leveled out in the 90s, so you don't have that pressure on the church there. But a parallel to the church's tactic of enforcing family ideals in a positive, non-coercive manner can be found in the treatment of birth control. Now, when birth control began to be widely available in the early part of the 20th century, all Christian churches opposed it. That was considered to be quite immoral to practice birth control. But the Mormon emphasis eventually shifted from prohibition of birth control to stressing the glory of large families. And compare that with the approach taken by the Roman Catholic Church, which prohibited contraception altogether and has arguably lost a lot of authority and credibility over that issue. So the LDS positive emphasis on having large families, if it doesn't produce any more children, at least you don't alienate people who just are not able to follow that. Similarly, in the case of employment of women, outright prohibition puts too many members in the position of having to choose between following the prophet and meeting the needs of the family, by instead stressing the importance of parenting, family, devoted motherhood, and by praising women and their innate virtues and strength, the church has found a way to turn its difference with society into an appealing feature rather than a repellent bug.
Well, here we have an analysis that helps helps us understand the current LDS view of motherhood, an idyllic view, and I'm struck with the question of how do you stand up and criticize that idyllic view unless you are also prepared to be lumped in the category of people who also hate puppies and, you know, birthday parties for little children. A lot of very wonderful and idyllic things there that are very inspiring, very noble, and very enlarging in many ways. I guess what for me, after trying to synthesize and digest this trajectory and assimilate what it is that that concerns me most about the current view and testimony of motherhood, I guess I could sum up in perhaps a somewhat different title to the paper. Perhaps a title more along the lines of Modern Mormonism's View of Motherhood: Cultural Cognitive Dissonance Reduction Run Amok. or perhaps the patronization of women as corrective for the negative effects of patriarchy. You gotta think about that one for a minute. What we're faced with is the need to accommodate our practices, but a lack of willingness to change or address our core beliefs and ideals, no matter how much inconsistency results. If that kind of condition persists in an individual and in an individual's worldview, the psychologists have a term for that. It's called schizophrenia. If that condition persists in an entire organization, the organizational psychologists don't have a term at that level that would convey the same sort of diagnosis. We call it, you know, dysfunction or organizational misbehavior, things along those lines. Understanding where we are and understanding the current condition objectively, rationally, consistently, is what most psychologists will tell us is in almost all 12-step self-help programs the first step towards recovery. But the question is, once you you get past that that self-awareness, then what sorts of obstacles do you face towards true gender equality, towards a view of motherhood that makes that gender equality possible? I know that's maybe taking Carrie's contribution today and going a couple of steps further in terms of, okay, now what are the implications? I guess that's kind of what, in terms of my reaction, the questions that that jumped out at me. Okay, we've got this analysis, we understand where we are, and so what do we do about it? Of course, the biggest problem I face in terms of trying to address or maybe, you know, move beyond these inconsistencies and work towards some sense of rationality within the church is to explain or, you know, to point out the current role, the current testimony, the current idyllic view of motherhood within the church, and then say, yeah, we're saying it is A and not A at the same time, and to have perfectly intelligent, rational Orthodox members of the church look at you and go, yeah, I don't see the inconsistency. Much like a conversation I had some years back, summarizing briefly, I was talking to another high priest in my ward. It was when the proclamation on the family first came out. I suggested that there might be some difficulty with this notion that men and women are equal, but the man presides. His response to me was that, well, men and women are equal, they're equal partners. And it seemed to me that the question raised the inconsistency, but he just flat out didn't have a problem with it. So I said, well, tell me more. What, you know, how does that work, that they're equal partners, but the man presides? And he says, well, it's a lot like a bishopric. They're all partners in a bishopric. And having been in a bishopric, I said, well, okay, in a bishopric, you know, all the members are partners, but I asked, doesn't the bishop hold that authority trump card? So there really aren't all equals, are they? And he says, well, that's true, but they are all equal partners. It's just that the bishop is more equal than the others. Yeah, shades of animal form. And we've got a few minutes, and I'll turn this over very quickly to Q&A, I made a plug for Carrie's book early on. I'm very serious about that. It's a wonderful, meaty treatise for those who have the mental teeth and inclination and the discipline to avoid, you know, the cultural remote control, get my attention in 15 seconds, and have the time and the ability to wade through something substantive. I would also suggest, those of you who weren't in this same room earlier, to get your hands on a copy of the tape of Margaret Toscano's wonderful synthesis of the question, are boys more important than women? She suggested a couple of questions that we face in the church to true gender equality. One has to do with ambiguity with respect to the desirability of power. Second has to do with the belief that church structure reflects the will of God as we see institutionalized in, you know, fatherhood and priesthood, and priesthood being tantamount to the institutional authority. But it also struck me as I was listening to her presentation just the hour before that it's very difficult to change church doctrine in a church that is the one and only true church, and where gender roles are divinely mandated, and we've got a cultural sense that our role nowadays is among the institutional church is the need to keep our doctrine pure. Until we get past this idea that we've got an implicit sense of The whole statement that I heard a few years back at a regional conference from one of the members of the presiding 15, that one of their central roles was to keep our doctrine pure, assumes that our doctrine already is pure. I mean, how do you jettison that? I mean, how do you jettison the kind of thinking that creates these inconsistencies where, on the one hand, you have a proclamation on the family that says, we believe that marriage is ordained of God and that is only between a man and a woman, when in fact right now we have three living apostles who are polygamists, are they not? And I haven't had that conversation yet with a member of my high priest group, but I can't wait to see where that leads. It's like, well, no, that's, we've abandoned the practice. And, according to a church, CES church history, it was in 1890, but in fact, if that were the case, we wouldn't have needed the second manifesto in 1904. But for the most part, the church today, the LDS church, we have abandoned the practice, but we have not abandoned the doctrine. And until, as a church, we're ready to stand up and repudiate that doctrine, it makes it very difficult to sort through the kind of schizophrenia that I think make at least me and others very uncomfortable with this idyllic notion. So no, I don't hate puppies. No, I don't hate birthday parties for little children. And I always call my mother on Mother's Day. So with that, we'll go ahead and open up for questions. And if you would, come on down here to the microphone so we can get them on tape. Come up after. We'll talk about that. Three remarried.
So we're all standing here to bear our testimony? It's
scary, I know that you're true. I had a really interesting experience several years ago when I was married but did not yet have children, and my brother and his wife did. And I was sitting in Relief Society next to my sister-in-law, and the two mothers in Zion talk was the lesson for Relief Society that Sunday. And it came up, and I was in my parents' ward, and I'm like, I hate this talk. And my sister-in-law said, and this was an eye-opener for me, she said, I love it because it makes me feel so good about the choices that I have made. And it struck me, I was like, I guess it doesn't bother you to be pigeonholed if you're a pigeon. So it doesn't bother you to be pigeonholed if you are a pigeon. If you're not a pigeon, it's painful. My other thing is, a few years ago, we bought a house, and we live in Portland. We live in a very liberal neighborhood. We're the only Mormons for blocks and blocks and blocks. And one of my neighbors is a stay-at-home mom of three boys, and talking with her, and she would say, yeah, I just feel like there's just no support for stay-at-home moms in our culture. And I'm like, wow. Well, in my culture, that's the only thing that's supported is to be a stay-at-home mom. So it was kind of, that was another kind of eye-opening experience for me about this issue.
I have a comment and a question. When I was hired as women's editor of the Ensign in 1973, the Ensign had taken over, by divine fiat, the Relief Society magazine, and there was still quite a bit of resistance to that. And one of the complaints in one of the first years that I was there in 1974, 1975 was that the Relief Society president, then Barbara B. Smith, who was not exactly an activist, said that I looked in the index and there was nothing listed under women. And Todd, the editor, said, we'll fix that. And so the instructions were to find anything vaguely related to women for the next year's index and be sure there was a lengthy list of items. So it was a political decision. And even though I realized you had to put a chronological boundary on the authoritative statements that you presented today, would you comment on Dallin Oaks' talk at April conference in which he defined patriarchy as partnership when it occurs in the home?
I think that has to do with what Mike was talking about, you know, how do you maintain this? And this is an issue that conservative Christianity in general is struggling with. Something like 89% of all evangelical Christians surveyed will say that the husband is the head of the household. There's a lot of disagreement about what that means, but that also 87% will say that marriage is a partnership of equals. So I think there's a real defining down of what patriarchy, what it means to preside, what it means to be the boss or the head of the household, becoming more accommodating. But they're still trying to hang on to this language that has been deified, reified in a lot of ways. You probably have more to say about Dallin Oaks than I do.
All right, thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but those who still have questions, please come forward, and maybe we can have an informal conversation.